Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Today on Edgewise, our guest is Josh Burson. He's the principal and founder of Burson & Associates, the leading provider of research and consulting services in e-learning technology and implementation. Josh has worked with hundreds of companies in the development, management, and measurement of high-impact blended learning programs. He's author of the Blended Learning book, Best Practices, Proven Methodologies, and Lessons Learned. Josh, welcome to Edgewise.
Thank you, Dave.
Josh, certainly when the recession started, there was a significant drop in investment in learning and development. Has that continued?
There was a dramatic reduction in spending and learning and development in the corporate sector over the last 2.5 years. Almost 22%, according to our data. And that wreaked havoc on training professionals, many of whom were laid off, but many of whom were forced to shut down classes, spend less money on content, buy fewer tools. But that is just turning around. Our research that just came out in January, what we call the Corporate Learning Factbook, shows a 2 or 3% increase in spending. Starting late last year, training spending is a little bit of a lagging indicator of the economy, but the companies we talk to are telling us that it's time to spend again. What happened during the downturn was not just layoffs, but a further shift in adoption of technology and what we call informal learning.
What is that?
The concept of informal learning is not new, but it's becoming a buzzword right now. If you ask most business professionals, how do high-performing employees become good at their jobs, 72% of them will tell you they learn it on the job. Only rarely will they say, oh, he went to a really good class, and after that class, he came back and became really good at his job. But how does the training department, who has money to spend, incorporate all of the informal learning and on-the-job experiences that take place in their formal training? That is now becoming the discipline of informal learning. And what happened during the recession was because so many formal training programs were cut, training departments and HR people said, we need to figure out ways to build skills by creating collaborative experiences, by creating communities of practice, by developing knowledge portals, by getting the experts to share their information with the non-experts, all of which are valuable things, but they're not formal.
What about soft skills? Was there a significant drop in that area as well?
There's two kinds of soft skills training. There's leadership development training, which is everything from first-line supervisory up to top executive education, and generic soft skills, which would be topics like how to communicate, how to have a meeting, how to manage projects. The generic soft skills training in most companies is usually off the shelf. It's content that companies buy from vendors. What they can do during a recession is not buy it, or they can buy a cheaper version of it, and oftentimes just put it off for a year or two, or maybe have some old-fashioned e-learning. The more strategic type of soft skills training, leadership development, while it does get cut somewhat during a recession, smarter companies usually don't do away with that because if they're relatively well-run businesses, they know that a continuous investment in leaders is important even during layoffs because it's the leaders that are making the decisions during the tough times just like the good times. So those programs tend to suffer a little bit less.
Josh, what kind of leadership learning are we talking about?
The leadership development that is more strategic in companies includes classroom training, coaching, 360 assessments, which is assessment of leaders, competency development programs where companies will come in and they will look at the competencies of high-performing leaders and they will say, oh, in our company, successful executives are really good at this. And therefore, we're going to replicate that because these are the things that make people successful in our company. For example, at Apple, over the last 3 years, they've built a very highly customized internal training program to teach Apple leaders how Apple runs the company. And it's completely proprietary and unique and specific to Apple. So it's not general management techniques, it's how Apple manages its companies. Those are the kinds of programs that most businesses don't do away with during recessions, although some do.
And I think another thing is that companies are well aware of the need to maintain a pipeline of individuals to step into leadership spots.
Absolutely. In fact, this topic of the leadership pipeline comes up again and again, year after year, as the biggest challenge amongst HR executives. Even during recessions, it comes up. There's a whole bunch of reasons for it, but particularly now, one of the reasons is a lot of the people in their 50s and 60s are retiring. There's been a gap in the demographics in the United States and in some countries of people in their 30s. So there actually are fewer employees in the emerging leader category than there were in the baby boomer category. So it's more important to select them and identify who they are. Frankly, what a leader does in a successful company today is different from what a traditional leader probably did in the 1950s and 1960s. Companies are very networked. People work from home. They're very global, very multicultural. Companies tend to operate in highly empowered teams. So the characteristics of leadership today are not the traditional GE Jack Welch model. So the problems of leadership development in companies are fairly big. And every day almost, you'll find a company in the Wall Street Journal that's going through a leadership crisis of some kind because either a top executive left or they're going through a major shakeup and the executives are not dealing with it well. It's a big, enduring problem that goes on year after year in companies.
Josh, can you give us an example of a company that's streamlining its training or maybe identifying strategic initiatives or something along those lines?
Just last week, I met with the chief learning officer of Cisco. Cisco is one of the most successful high-tech companies. They've survived at least two major recessions in a very competitive technology environment. They've invested very heavily in training and learning over the years. They used to pride themselves on the fact that they spent more money on training than their competitors. During the last business cycle, they decided that they were spending too much, so they appointed an executive as the chief learning officer, someone who didn't come from training. And this particular person's job was to consolidate dozens and dozens of training departments inside of Cisco into one. This is a very common strategy that companies go through during cost cutting. Training has a tendency to distribute itself naturally into every part of the company. If you're a head of sales and you're not getting support on training, you'll find somebody in the department and you'll say, hey, you can do the training. And pretty soon there's 25 little training groups all over the company. What Cisco did is consolidated this under one executive. And what he's been doing for 18 months is looking for areas of duplication, places where they can create standards. And he's trying to build a model where 50 to 60% of the training around the company is done in a similar way, where only 20, 30, 40% is custom in each department. He's already lopped off 30 or 40% of the budget just through restructuring. That's happening in many, many companies. That just happened at Citibank. That happened at Bank of America. That's a very common way that companies have dealt with the downturn. And by the way, what usually comes out of all that work is a lot of whittling away at some of the things the company didn't need in the first place that just sprung up during times of growth.
That's an interesting point, but can you share with us some other restructuring approaches that you have heard of?
There's a whole variety of ways that companies can save money in training. Restructuring and centralization is definitely one. A second is to, rather than restructure, reallocate a learning portfolio. In most companies, there are dozens or hundreds of training programs, some of which are online, some of which are classroom. Many of them are underutilized or sometimes not utilized at all. It's a little bit of a project, but it's well worth the time to go through enrollments, satisfaction levels, attendance records, and looking at the programs that just are not being utilized. And a third approach that many companies go through is something that we developed through our research, comparing training investments to the current business strategies of the company, creating an alignment exercise, and we have a tool for this.
even though there might be classes that people are going to because they really like the class, they may not be pushing the company in the direction that the company wants to go. There may be other programs that are more strategic. And that exercise will often result in the company spending a lot of money on a very few programs. Because if you really look at how many training programs are needed to make a company successful, it's really not that many during tough times. So going through that investment portfolio exercise allows a company to temporarily hold back on some of the more tactical operational things and invest in the strategic things in a greater way.
All right. In light of the economy, it seems that there would be less outsourcing of training and more internalizing of it.
Outsourcing means a lot of things to a lot of people. In the training industry, outsourcing is absolutely necessary to be successful because no training department has expertise in all of the topics that a company needs. So during tough times, companies will outsource content that they don't have the time to build because it might be available off the shelf at a low cost and it's good enough. But the bigger outsourcing, which is outsourcing the development of custom content or the operations of the training department, those are things that are usually done during tough times very carefully because there just isn't enough money to go around. But if you know which of the programs you have that are highly strategic to your company, for example, at Ford right now, there's a major emphasis on retraining engineers to understand the technologies for electric vehicles. There's a lot of education that needs to be done on power supplies and motors and batteries and subsystems of electric cars. I guarantee you Ford's investing heavily in that. Are they investing in training on traditional internal combustion engine technology? Probably not. That's probably something they can outsource to a lower cost training provider.
Okay, now talent management is another one of those terms that has become very popular. What is your definition of it?
Talent management describes the integration of some of the more traditional HR practices into an integrated approach. If you look at recruiting, if you look at the process of performance management, ranking and rating employees, the process of succession management, identifying who's available to potentially move into leadership, who are the people that we want to promote, who are the people that we don't want to promote. If you look at the process of leadership development itself, how do we train leaders? The process of compensation, how do we decide how much to pay people and who's going to get a bonus and who's not? The process of training and career development, how do people move around inside of the company? What are the potential jobs they should have next after the one they have? Each one of those practices used to be done by a person or an HR group. There was a recruiting group. There was a leadership group. There was a succession group. There was a performance management group. There was a compensation group. And they all optimized their own little group to do that thing well. But what makes a company successful is its ability to adapt quickly and to make changes. So if you're Ford and you want to get into the electric vehicle business and you want to open a plant in China, you probably need to hire or train or develop or move a whole bunch of engineers into new jobs. So any one of those groups may not be able to solve that problem. It's the way they all work together. Talent management is the discipline of tying these traditional HR practices together, often using software, but really using business processes and practices, to be much more strategic and adaptable on how training and HR take place. In about a third of companies today, there now is somebody, the VP or the director of talent management, whose job is to create the connections between the traditional approaches in management and HR to create a strategic process around it. And it's a very important initiative in organizations today.
And it seems to be on an increase.
Absolutely. It's very much a growing area of HR and business. We started doing research on it around 2004, 2005. The word became popular around 2006, 2007. But today, there's conferences on it, there's books on it. A lot of people have had jobs doing talent management. It's still growing very rapidly, but about half the companies we survey do not have a talent management strategy. They don't understand it yet. So for all the companies that are doing it well, there's plenty of organizations that are still working on figuring it out.
Well, let's talk a little bit about blended learning.
Blended learning has been around at least since 2004, and the concept is just as powerful today as it ever was. And the concept is simply that human beings don't learn anything by doing one thing. You don't learn something by reading about it. You don't learn something by sitting in a class. You learn it well by experiencing it in a whole variety of ways. You hear somebody talk about it, you watch a video, you do some exercises, you try it, you fail, you get some coaching, you get some feedback, you might take a simulation, you might take a test. All those things added together are what creates mastery. And ultimately, the goal of training or corporate learning isn't just to educate people like it is in school, it's to make them better at their jobs. And if they're not better at their jobs, it really doesn't matter if they scored well on a test. So blended learning is taking e-learning and other forms of training and mixing them together in a form that's appropriate for a given topic. So in sales training, for example, nobody's going to learn how to sell anything by watching somebody talk about it on a video on your computer. But you'll learn some basic principles, and if you try them in real life and you get some feedback and maybe your manager or somebody gives you some coaching, they will be good foundational principles.
Okay. But I'm just curious, is the quality of the learning systems improving?
Now that we have a huge amount of technology and tools available on the internet, e-learning includes videos, simulations, assessments, collaborative experiences where you can go online and chat with other people and share information. So e-learning's evolved a lot in the 12 or 13 years that the term's been around. But the availability of content is constantly changing, so you can go out and buy some e-learning that's still the old-fashioned type, and then you can buy e-learning and build e-learning that's very modern and very exciting and very dynamic, too.
Josh, what can executives do to support learning taking place in their organizations?
One of the most important things we've learned over the years in our research is that much of training of any kind without management and executive support is wasted. So if you as an employee go to a class or take some developmental program and you go back into the office and no one supports it or cares that you took it or even understands what you learned, you may get some value out of it, but the ultimate value is very much diminished. So executives and particularly line managers need to understand what the training programs are, why they're important, and should participate in them. If it's a program that has any significant value to the organization, managers should be involved in reinforcing the program. So management and executives play a very important role in the whole learning and development function.
And they should, I would think, be trying to align the learning to any kind of strategic initiatives the company has planned.
Mm-hmm. Making it relevant is a leader's job. I, as an employee, might think it's a good idea for me to go to a class in X, but I may not know that that class has other strategic benefits to the company that would make it even more important for me to go. So for an executive or a manager to say, you know what, we want you to go to this, we want you to learn these topics because that's the future of our company and that's where we're going, makes it even more exciting and motivating and useful to the employees themselves.
Now, another term we're hearing quite a bit is learning culture. Why don't you tell us about that?
Learning culture is turning out to be a fascinating, very important topic. What it essentially means is this. If you're, say, the CEO of a company or you're a manager of a small work group and you want people to move in some new direction, you want them to change their behavior in some way, maybe to improve quality, maybe to go after a new market, maybe to focus on a different business area, they're going to have to learn something new to do that. There's a reason they're not doing it today. Some of it has to do with motivation and management. Some of it has to do with skills and behaviors. The learning culture is the collective set of practices and management behaviors that allows the company or the organization to adapt and learn. For example, Nokia is a very well-known company that was one of the most successful makers of cell phones for many, many years, until the touchscreen came along. Nokia had a touchscreen cell phone 3 to 4 years before Apple. but it didn't get out of development. And the reason it didn't get out of development was Nokia's culture did not support the development of new ideas and the continuous learning. And perhaps the engineers that were working on the old kinds of cell phones didn't want to learn about the new kinds of cell phones because they were invested in the old user interfaces. That may be the death of Nokia's cell phone business. Now they've basically done a deal where they've licensed their whole software away and they're going to be developing it entirely on Microsoft because they couldn't learn fast enough how to adapt to their own business. This was a business they were already number one in. One in three cell phones at one time were Nokia cell phones.
Very interesting. Do you have any other examples?
One company that has a good learning culture is IBM. IBM in the 1980s was a mainframe computer company. It became a personal computer company. It became a mini computer company. Then it became a software company. Then it became a consulting company. The people that work at IBM are continuously expected to change and learn and adapt. And there's all sorts of business practices around that that enable that company to adapt and grow. Most of the businesses that you read about that disappeared didn't disappear because they didn't have smart people. They didn't disappear because they didn't have good ideas or they didn't have enough cash. It's because they didn't learn fast enough about the world going on around them. And a lot of that has to do with culture.
And what do experts mean by a high-impact learning culture?
In our research, we came up with what we call a high-impact learning culture. That was the name of the research. And we identified 40 practices that very highly correlate to learning. One of them, just a simple one that most companies need to think about, is are executives open to bad news? When somebody from the trenches says, this product, nobody wants it anymore because it has this feature that's broken, do people listen to that and respond to it and adapt to it or not? Some organizations do, some organizations don't. So there's a whole bunch of little things like that that have a lot to do with business success, not just corporate training, many of which are management behaviors that create an open, collaborative, empowered learning culture, some of which are very hard to do.
Josh, is there one thing that you would advise companies to do first?
The simple, single, most important thing in learning and training is alignment. It's very easy to spend money on building or buying or licensing various types of training, developing it, rolling it out, trying to measure whether people like it or not. But the thing that's the hardest is making sure it's very well aligned with the business problems you're trying to solve. The simple thing to remind yourself is, of all of the things that you're doing in training, which are the ones that are making your company or your organization more competitive, gain market share, grow against the competition, improve margins? A lot of training programs are not. A lot of them are kind of, this will keep us out of trouble. This will reduce our costs. This will make people a little more productive. And those are programs that may not be as well aligned as the strategic ones. If you can think about alignment, and that includes during the development process of a training program, what problem are you trying to solve? What are the specific behaviors you would like to have come out different? If you can think that way on an individual program level and at an organizational level, then you'll always have a training function that's adding a lot of value.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have any concluding thoughts before we wrap up the program? Anything you want to leave our listeners with?
The final thing I would say is whether you're in management or leadership or HR or training or first-line supervisor, I cannot overemphasize the value of development. People need continuous development in their roles, regardless of the role. Businesses are constantly changing. Technology and tools are constantly changing. It's a strong motivator of employee satisfaction. In fact, the ability for people to gain access to the skills they need to improve their professional careers and their roles is often found to be the most important issue in retention. So don't take it lightly. It isn't you send somebody off to a class and hope they learn something. It has a very profound value in organizations, and it's worth spending time on.
We've been talking to Josh Burson of Burson & Associates, author of the Blended Learning book, best practices, proven methodologies, and lessons learned. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
AMA training courses are now available direct to your desktop. Our virtual seminars deliver the power of AMA training without the travel, without time away from the office, but with the ability to catapult your skill set and career to new heights. For more information, visit amanet.org/virtual-seminars. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.